There are powers behind the scenes that really think very highly of nations going to war against other nations and everybody going into large amounts of debt, huge amounts of things being destroyed, and of course national attitudes being shaken to the point where they can bring about, as Lincoln Bloomfield described it in the 1962 report for the State Department, a revolution in world political affairs. And I think we're getting closer to that, this polycrisis that the world...
You're watching Silver News Daily. Subscribe for more.
Everything you're being told about the world right now is designed to keep you distracted. Because behind the noise, something much bigger is unfolding. Governments are scrambling, conflicts are spreading across multiple regions, debt is exploding to levels we've never seen before, and yet somehow, the official narrative is that everything is under control. But what if it's not? What if the cracks are already too deep to fix? Because when you step back and really look at what's happening, a different picture starts to emerge. You've got wars escalating across multiple theaters. You've got oil prices surging past critical levels. You've got global trade routes being disrupted. And at the same time, currencies are quietly losing their purchasing power. This isn't random. This is a system under pressure from every angle. And history tells us that when systems reach this point, they don't stabilize. They break. And here's where it gets even more interesting. There are voices, people who have been watching this for years, who are now saying, we are entering what they call a polycrisis, a moment where multiple global breakdowns happen at once, feeding into each other and accelerating the collapse of stability. And if that's true, then what we're seeing right now isn't the peak of the chaos. It's just the beginning. Because while most people are focused on headlines and short-term events, the real shift is happening underneath the surface. Confidence in governments is eroding. Trust in financial systems is fading. And when that trust disappears, money doesn't just sit still. It moves. Fast. So the real question isn't just what's happening in the world right now. The real question is this. When the system everyone depends on starts to fail, where does the smart money go? And more importantly, why are so few people paying attention to the one asset that has historically exploded in moments exactly like this?
Eddie, even with the little bit that's known publicly, that the communist Chinese are involved, that the Russians are involved, of course, the U.S. government is involved, the European players are trying to figure out what to do. But this has very rapidly become an international conflagration. We've got governments and countries all over the world that have found themselves tangled up in this, including a whole bunch of the fellow Muslim governments in the region, the Arab states in the Gulf. So this is a really big deal. And there haven't really been clearly defined objectives yet. It's kind of been all over the place. You know, first we got to do it because the protests, and then there's Israel, and then there's nuclear weapons. And, you know, we don't quite know what the objective is. It went from not regime change to regime change. So it's really kind of all over the map right now, but it is having incredibly significant economic effects. Obviously, we see shipping coming to a virtual standstill through the Strait of Hormuz, with companies refusing to provide insurance at anything that companies can pay. And now the U.S. government's getting involved in this. Trump said he had ordered a very obscure U.S. agency to get working on figuring out how we can get insurance for these ships for if they suffer a loss because of a war. But I suspect this is going to get crazy. I mean, as we're speaking right now, oil just crossed over $100 a barrel. I suspect it will go higher. And really, this should have been obvious that this was coming. I invested heavily in defense stocks just because the writing was on the wall years ago, even before Trump became president again, that this was going to be coming. And I think the big concern now is, what if the communist Chinese, what if the Russians see this as their opportunity to go ahead and do what they want to do, right? The communist Chinese have been talking about taking Taiwan. The Russians now have an opportunity to steamroller over Ukraine. And this could very quickly become huge. And, you know, the fact that Pete Hegseth, and I know Pete, I think he's a great guy. I was very grateful that he endorsed my book. I worked with him on his series for Fox on education. I really like the guy. But, you know, to hear him talking about how, oh, we got plenty of munitions, we're going to be able to sustain this for as long as necessary. To me, that sounds like we might be running out of munitions. I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much into it. But I think we're in a very, very dangerous situation right now. Of course, we wish the people of Iran well. Nobody wants to defend the pretty brutal regime that Jimmy Carter helped bring to power there, the Ayatollahs. But this is a whole new world. And I think it may get worse before it gets better.
What we're witnessing right now isn't just a series of isolated events, it's a convergence of pressure points that are all hitting the system at once. And when you connect those dots, the idea of controlled chaos starts to make a lot more sense. Because think about it. You've got nations being pushed into conflict. You've got governments piling on unimaginable levels of debt. And you've got entire economies being destabilized at the same time. Historically, these kinds of conditions don't just happen randomly or independently. They tend to align during periods of massive structural change. There's actually been discussion at high levels about using crisis as a catalyst, not just reacting to it, but allowing it to reshape the global order. The concept of a polycrisis has been openly talked about, where multiple crises, economic, geopolitical, and social, are all triggered or intensified at once, creating a kind of chain reaction that fundamentally alters the world stage. And when you look at what's happening today, it's hard to ignore how closely reality is mirroring that framework. You've got war driving up energy prices, which feeds directly into inflation. You've got inflation eroding purchasing power, which leads to social instability. You've got central banks responding with policies that often create even more long-term damage. And all of this is happening while global debt continues to spiral, reaching levels that are mathematically impossible to repay under the current system. It's not just one problem, it's a feedback loop, and every part of it is amplifying the next. But here's where it becomes critical to understand the bigger picture. When systems are pushed to this level of stress, they don't just bend, they transform. The rules change. The structures that people rely on start to shift, sometimes gradually, sometimes all at once. And throughout history, these moments have always been accompanied by massive transfers of wealth, not because of luck, but because a small number of people recognize what's happening early and position themselves before the rest of the world catches on. So while most people are still trying to make sense of individual headlines, the real story is the pattern that's forming underneath. A system being pushed to its limits, a world being reshaped through overlapping crises, and a financial landscape that is becoming increasingly unstable by the day. And once you see that pattern clearly, it raises an even more important question. If this really is a coordinated, or at least an accelerating breakdown, what happens next when the economic consequences start to fully hit?
The rules of the game have clearly changed, right? Under the Trump administration, we have certain long established, I don't know if you want to call them international norms, that are increasingly being cast aside. The capture of Nicolas Maduro is a really good example of that. The deliberate targeting for assassination of the government leader of Iran, the Ayatollah Khomeini, this opens up a whole new world when it comes to warfare, especially when you look at some of the targeting that has been going on in Iran. I mean, we're not just targeting the leaders for assassination. In many cases, we're hitting their personal homes, where presumably their wives and their children would be. So we're in kind of a new world when it comes to conflict. And even the United Nations has been talking about this, right? We're throwing long established international rules to the side. And when it comes to Iran, it's hard to know exactly what their capabilities are. I think the U.S. government thinks it knows what their capabilities are, but I don't think it necessarily has a full picture. I think the Iranians have a lot of missiles, and I think at this point it's very clear that the communist Chinese are helping them and that they're also getting some help from the Russians. How much depends on a number of things, and there are various sources reporting different things, some of which may be more credible than others, but it certainly seems like they're helping with intelligence support at the very least, and whether that makes them active belligerents or not is a whole nother question. But we've also got this very interesting Sunni-Shia divide, which, for now, the U.S. government and the Israelis have been able to exploit. But would they be more inclined to unite with fellow Muslims over the long term? We'll see.
Just before we get going, we just launched the official Silver News Daily Telegram. To kick things off, we're running a 10-ounce silver giveaway. Yes, real physical silver, not a voucher, not digital credits, actual bullion. This Telegram will be our new home for real-time silver discussions, market insights, collection picks, and everything precious metals. It's where the community truly comes alive. Here's how to enter the 10-ounce silver giveaway. Be subscribed to Silver News Daily on YouTube. Turn on the notification bell, comment 10-ounce giveaway on 3 separate videos. Be an active member of the Telegram group and say hi. Once we hit 500 active Telegram members, we'll pick one lucky winner to receive 10 ounces of silver shipped directly to you. So get in early, stay active. Now, when you zoom in on what these conflicts are actually doing to the global economy, the scale of the disruption becomes impossible to ignore. This isn't just about headlines or geopolitical tension. This is about the arteries of the global system being squeezed in real time. Trade routes that the world depends on are becoming unstable, insurance costs for shipping are surging to levels that make transport economically unviable, and entire supply chains are starting to fracture under the pressure. Take energy as the clearest example. The moment conflict begins to threaten key choke points, oil doesn't just rise gradually, it spikes aggressively. We've already seen prices pushing past critical thresholds, and when energy moves like that, it doesn't stay isolated. It feeds directly into everything. Transportation costs rise, manufacturing costs rise, food prices rise, and suddenly inflation isn't something central banks can manage anymore. It becomes embedded into the system. And this is where the ripple effect really starts to accelerate. Because as inflation surges, central banks are forced into a corner. Either they raise rates and risk collapsing already fragile economies, or they keep printing and allow currencies to lose even more value. There is no clean solution here, only trade-offs. And every option leads to more instability down the line. At the same time, global trade itself is slowing. When major shipping lanes become high-risk zones and insurers pull back, goods simply stop moving at the scale they used to. That means shortages begin to appear, not always immediately, but gradually, and then all at once. We've seen how quickly that can spiral before, and this time the conditions are even more extreme. So what you end up with is a system being hit from multiple directions at once. Energy shock, supply chain disruption, inflationary pressure, and policy constraints all converging into a single outcome, a loss of stability. And when then stability goes, confidence follows. Investors start looking for safety, institutions start repositioning, and capital begins to move out of traditional assets that depend on a functioning system. And that's the turning point. Because once money starts moving defensively, it doesn't trickle, it floods. The question then becomes, where can it go in a world where currencies are weakening, markets are volatile, and trust in the system itself is starting to break down?
Yeah, I think the communist Chinese are watching this with great interest. They if we're honest and realistic here, they've been waging war on the United States for generations. Not a shooting war, but they've been waging what they describe as a people's war. And this is a term that their own senior military leadership uses from the People's Liberation Army. And this people's war is basically everything short of guns, bullets, bombs, etc. So it includes financial warfare, economic warfare. It includes biological warfare. It includes all these different tactics. And they have been biding their time quietly, hoping that at some point they'll be able to basically have the military power to conclusively defeat the United States if a war were to emerge. And I think they think they're getting closer to that time. Whether they are or not, you know, it's a whole nother question. Again, there's a lot of different opinions on where they are militarily. Of course, a lot of their technology they've gotten from us. They've stolen from our universities, our companies, our government. Bill Clinton helped them out a little bit with that. I think the CCP is a formidable foe, and I don't think they necessarily oppose this war. I think they're watching it with great interest. They're getting some insight into American capabilities. They're, I think, watching with glee as the U.S. government goes deeper into debt to fight another war. You know, if you read Sun Tzu, there's a lot of insight there into the way the Chinese think about warfare. And in fact, their military leaders still read these texts today. So I think they're watching very, very carefully. And I think when they look at the debt level that the U.S. government has right now, the $40 trillion in debt, the at least $200 trillion in unfunded liabilities, you look at our capacity to sustain a long, serious war. We just don't have it anymore, right? The communist Chinese can crank out ships and missiles like there's no tomorrow. The U.S. industrial base has been hollowed out and shipped to China, thanks, obviously, to the leadership, political and business of the United States going back 4 or 5 decades now. So we're in a very dangerous situation when it comes to the Chinese, and I think they're waiting for the moment to be right for them to go ahead and attack Taiwan and try to capture it. And I think they want to do that once they know that the U.S. government will be
But while most people are focused on tanks, missiles, and headlines about escalating conflict, there's another battlefield that's far more important, and it's one that almost no one is talking about openly. It's the financial battlefield. Because in today's world, you don't need to fire a single shot to destabilize an enemy. You just need to weaken their currency, disrupt their markets, and slowly erode confidence in their financial system. And this is exactly where the strategy begins to shift. Nations like China have spent decades preparing for this kind of environment, not by rushing into direct confrontation, but by building influence through what can only be described as economic and financial warfare. Instead of bullets, it's trade agreements, currency positioning, resource control, and strategic accumulation of real assets. It's slower, It's quieter, but in many ways, it's far more effective. Because think about the position the United States finds itself in right now. Massive debt, STT money creation, and a currency that the entire world has relied on for decades. That system only works as long as there is trust. As long as other nations are willing to hold dollars, settle trade in dollars, and base their reserves around it. But what happens when that trust starts to fade? What happens when major global players begin looking for alternatives? We're already starting to see the early signs of that shift. Bilateral trade agreements bypassing the dollar. Central banks increasing their holdings of gold. Strategic alliances forming that are designed specifically to reduce dependence on the existing financial system. This isn't speculation. It's a gradual realignment of power, and it's happening in real time. And here's the key point that most people miss. Financial warfare doesn't create instant collapse. It creates slow, compounding pressure. It chips away at stability piece by piece until suddenly the system reaches a tipping point. And when that tipping point is hit, the move is fast, decisive, and often irreversible. So while the world watches military developments unfold, the real transformation is happening underneath, in currencies, in reserves, in trade systems, and in confidence itself. And if that transformation continues at the pace we're seeing now, it leads directly into a much bigger question. What happens to a system built entirely on debt and trust when both of those pillars start to give way at the same time?
Able to successfully defend, whether that be because we're too tied up in another area of the world, say the Middle East, or because we just don't have the financial wherewithal and the munitions left. I think to them, it's all the same. But then, you know, behind the scenes, you have the globalists, and the globalists just love this stuff. They understand that war is the fastest catalyst for bringing about globalism. And I think we need to analyze it at that level as well. There are powers behind the scenes that really think very highly of nations going to war against other nations and everybody going into large amounts of debt, huge amounts of things being destroyed, and of course, national attitudes being shaken to the point where they can bring about, as Lincoln Bloomfield described it in the 1962 report for the State Department, a revolution in world political affairs. And I think we're getting closer to that, this polycrisis that the World Economic Forum has talked about.
Yeah, and could we zoom in a little bit on the financial aspects of the Chinese and Russians' actions in the last perhaps year and maybe the year in progress, and that is of selling of treasuries, dumping of dollars, and acquiring of gold. Any comments from you on how that accompanies the evidential weakening of the United States and the financial strengthening of them?
Yeah, I think this is a deliberate process that's being engineered. I think, and I've been reporting on this long before Trump became president, so it's, you know, it's not a Republican or a Democrat issue, but there is a deliberate agenda to undermine the United States and shift us over from the old unipolar world to a multipolar world order. And, you know, recently commentators have started talking about this. I've been talking about this for 15 years, but they couldn't do that as long as the U.S. was the most powerful economic, military, diplomatic player in the world. And so now I think we're entering a later stage where the controlled demolition of the United States, of our economy, of the U.S. dollar is accelerating. And whether Iran will be the straw that breaks the camel's back or whether we've got more straws still to be added on, I think it remains to be seen. But it certainly looks like we're approaching that. Now, the dollar has, of course, benefited a little bit from this war, but I think that's a short-term gain. And I think over the long term, this is going to, at the very least, contribute to, if not accelerate, the ongoing decline of the U.S. dollar, the ongoing decline of the U.S. government's financial position, and the ongoing decline of the U.S. government's relative military superiority over the rest of its possible adversaries very much.
Now, this is where everything starts to come together. Because when you look at the financial system itself, you begin to realize it's not just under pressure, it's structurally fragile. For decades, the entire global economy has been built on one core idea, that debt can keep expanding indefinitely without consequence. Governments borrow more to stimulate growth, central banks print more to support markets, and the whole system keeps moving forward as long as confidence remains intact. But here's the problem. We've now reached a point where that debt is no longer just large. It's unmanageable. Trillions upon trillions have been added in just a few short years. And the cost of servicing that debt is rising as interest rates increase. That creates a trap, because if rates stay high, governments struggle to pay their obligations. But if rates are lowered to relieve that pressure, currencies weaken even faster, and inflation accelerates. This is the corner the system has has backed itself into. There is no easy way out. Every path forward involves some form of pain, whether it's currency devaluation, economic contraction, or a loss of purchasing power on a scale most people aren't prepared for. And historically, when systems reach this level of imbalance, they don't just correct, they reset. You can already see the early warning signs. Currencies around the world are steadily losing value when measured against real goods and assets. Central banks, the very institutions that manage fiat systems, are quietly accumulating gold at record levels, not because they expect stability, but because they're preparing for instability. That alone should tell you everything about the direction things are heading. And this is where confidence becomes the deciding factor, because the entire fiat system is built on belief. Belief that currencies will hold value, that debts will be honored, that the system will continue to function as it always has. But once that belief starts to crack, even slightly, the effects can be rapid and severe. Capital doesn't wait around for confirmation. It moves at the first sign of risk. So what you're really looking at is a system that is mathematically stretched, politically strained, and increasingly fragile in the face of global disruption. A system where the margin for error has effectively disappeared. And when you combine that with everything we've already discussed, the conflicts, the financial warfare, the breakdown in global stability, it becomes clear that we're approaching a point where something has to give. And when it does, the shift won't just be economic, it will be behavioral. Investors, institutions, and even everyday people will begin searching for something outside of that system, something tangible, something that isn't tied to debt or dependent on trust. And that's where the next piece of this puzzle starts to come into focus. Because there's one asset that sits right at the intersection of monetary history and real-world necessity. And when this kind of transition begins, it doesn't just rise, it revalues.
You also have the connection with the Rockefellers, who, of course, have also been, I call them deep state behind the deep state money men, right? The Rothschilds and the Rockefellers together are two of the most powerful families, really, in the history of the world. These are financial dynasties that absolutely dominate business and economics and even government. There was always the old joke, why doesn't David Rockefeller run for president? Well, he doesn't want a demotion, right? So David Rockefeller put Jeffrey Epstein on the Trilateral Commission in 1990. Jeffrey Epstein joined the Council on Foreign Relations. In fact, he remained a member of the Council on Foreign Relations even after he pled guilty to procuring a child for prostitution, right? Which was, by the way, a sweetheart deal, so he wouldn't have to get in trouble for all the other incredible stuff he was doing, like sex trafficking children and things. So he clearly was involved with the pinnacle of deep state power, economic and government. The Rothschilds, of course, being right at the center of this. You know, the Rothschilds built up George Soros to give you some sense of the power. They built up Cecil Rhodes to give you some sense of the power of this dynasty. Their own apologist, like Niall Ferguson, who wrote The World's Banker about the Rothschild dynasty. This is like a court historian, right? An establishment pet says that the Rothschild dynasty decided the outcome of the Napoleonic Wars by financially supporting Britain. Right? Imagine the power of a family that can decide the outcome of a war between the two most powerful governments in the world, and you get a sense of what we're dealing with here. And so Epstein was running around like introducing himself as the Rothschilds' representative. That's what he said to Peter Thiel. Les Wexner, the only guy who's been publicly identified other than Maxwell as a co-conspirator by the FBI, publicly said in his deposition that most people didn't even hear about, that he was introduced to Epstein by the Rothschilds, that it was the Rothschilds who recommended Epstein. And of course, as we know, Epstein ended up getting very close to Les Wexner. Wexner claims he was conned. But all that to say, this is a guy who is way above intelligence agencies. You know, people are like, was he a CIA agent? The CIA is small potatoes compared to the world that Epstein was in. He was a level above that. And now the directed evolution of the transhumanism, you can't understand what Epstein was up to without understanding this element. So I mentioned the Southern Trust Company a moment ago that the Rothschilds sent tens of millions of dollars through. In Epstein's own words, the Southern Trust Company was a DNA analysis company that was taking DNA, analyzing it, and trying to putting it in a database and trying.
And this is where silver steps into a position that most people completely overlook, because it's not just another commodity. It sits at the crossroads of two worlds that are both under extreme pressure right now. On one side, you have the monetary system strained by debt, inflation, and declining trust. On the other, you have the industrial world, which is becoming more dependent on silver with every passing year. Historically, when confidence in currencies begins to break down, capital searches for something tangible, something that cannot be printed, manipulated, or devalued overnight. Gold has always played that role at the highest level, but silver is where things get far more explosive. Because unlike gold, silver is still accessible, still undervalued relative to its historical relationship with gold, and far more sensitive to shifts in demand. But here's what makes this moment different from anything we've seen before. Silver isn't just a monetary metal waiting for investment demand. It's a critical industrial resource that modern infrastructure depends on. Every solar panel, every electric vehicle, every advanced electronic system relies on silver's unique properties. And there is no true substitute. That means demand isn't just rising, it's becoming unavoidable. Now combine that with what we've already discussed. A financial system under stress, currencies losing credibility, and capital beginning to reposition. When investment demand returns as silver, it doesn't enter a market with unlimited supply. It collides with an already tight physical market that's being pulled in multiple directions at once. And this is where the pressure really starts to build. Because silver has spent years being undervalued, overlooked, and in many cases, suppressed relative to its true fundamentals. The gold-to-silver ratio remains historically elevated, signaling that silver is lagging far behind where it typically moves during periods of monetary stress. But that gap doesn't stay open forever. When it closes, it doesn't do so gradually. It snaps back with force. So what you end up with is a perfect storm forming beneath the surface. Monetary demand waiting for a trigger, industrial demand that cannot slow down, and a supply side that simply cannot respond fast enough to meet both at once. And when those forces converge, silver doesn't just move higher, it reprices rapidly, which leads directly into the next phase of this. Because if demand is building from both sides of the equation and supply is already constrained, what happens when the broader market finally wakes up and starts competing for a shrinking pool of physical silver?
Trying to understand genetics better. That's what he said about his own company. You look at the scientists that he had on his payroll, $9 million to Harvard, Arizona State University is the most frequently mentioned university. He had a guy at UCLA. He had all over the country some of the top scientists. And what were they studying? They were studying genetics. They were studying genetic engineering. They were studying evolution, they were studying artificial intelligence, and the nexus between all of those things. Then you combine that with some of the correspondence that we have from some of the victims. There's a girl in there who tells Epstein in a letter that was written in code, by the way, that, hey, I'm not your personal breeder, and I feel like you're using me as a breeder, and you kidnapped my baby that you made me had 10, 15 minutes after it was born, and she describes this baby. You've got another girl in there who says to Epstein that you offered to buy my baby when I was 6 months old. And some of this was public even before the documents. The New York Times, as terrible of a newspaper as it is, they did a good report in 2019 about Jeffrey Epstein hoping to seed the human race with his DNA, and they talked about the Zorro Ranch and what appeared to be evidence of plans to start a forced breeding program. So when you take it all together and you combine it with what we know about the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, you all know Harari, the Rothschilds, kind of where they want to go with all this, they believe that they can genetically engineer not just animals and plants, which we all know is happening, but also human beings. Jeffrey Epstein was communicating with a guy called Brian Bishop, who specializes in DNA storage, about creating designer babies and creating genetically engineered embryos, implanting them in women, and then giving birth to clones and genetically engineered babies. So I think you cannot understand Jeffrey Epstein without all of that information. I think right now we're only kind of seeing a vague outline of what he was up to, the tip of the iceberg, if you will. Obviously, the DOJ has redacted enormous amounts of material, including a lot of the people he was communicating with, which, by the way, they're not allowed to do by law. They were only allowed to redact for the victims. You mentioned the data breach that the FBI allegedly suffered, deleting enormous amounts of material. We also know that Epstein was tipped off before some of his properties were searched, allowing him to move huge amounts of data, storage, hard drives, pictures off of those properties before law enforcement showed up. So we're seeing the tip of the tip of the tip of the iceberg. And just what we've seen so far is, I think, probably the biggest scandal in the history of humanity, without exaggeration.
And as
now, this is where the situation becomes extremely fragile, because once the broader market starts to wake up, that the dynamic changes completely. Up until this point, silver has been moving under the radar, accumulated quietly, traded in relatively controlled volumes, with most people still focused on traditional assets. But that only works while attention is low. The moment awareness spreads, the entire structure of the market begins to shift. Because unlike stocks or digital assets, silver is a physical market at its core. There is a finite amount available, and a large portion of that supply is already spoken for by industrial demand. It's not sitting in vaults waiting to be bought. It's being consumed in real time. That means when new buyers enter the market, especially at scale, they're not just bidding up price, they're competing for something that is increasingly difficult to source. And we've seen glimpses of this before. Periods where premiums on physical silver spike, where delivery times stretch out, where the paper price and the real-world price begin to diverge. Those are early warning signs of stress in the system. Now imagine that environment, but amplified by a global shift in capital, where not just retail investors, but institutions, funds, and even sovereign players begin trying to secure physical metal at the same time. This is where the concept of a supply shock becomes very real. Because supply in the silver market isn't flexible. You can't Uberlaud flip a switch and double production. Mining output takes years to expand, and much of silver production is actually a byproduct of other mining operations, meaning it doesn't respond quickly to price signals. So when demand surges at Ganjin, Denben surges at Chonik, supply simply cannot keep up. And that's when the repricing happens, not as a slow, steady climb, but as a rapid adjustment to a new reality where the available supply is being overwhelmed. Prices gap higher, volatility increases, and the market begins to reflect the true scarcity that was always there, but largely ignored. At that point, it's no longer about finding the best price. It becomes about finding any supply at all. And historically, when markets reach that stage, the move is already well underway. The early positioning is done, the smart money is already in, and everyone else is reacting to a shift they didn't see coming. So the real inflection point isn't when silver starts moving, it's when access to physical silver starts tightening, because that's the signal that the underlying imbalance has finally broken into the open. And when that happens, the window of opportunity doesn't just narrow, it begins to close entirely, setting the stage for the final phase of this entire shift.
Amazing. We have now explosive evidence that there was a global ring of perverts who were trafficking children for sex with some of the most powerful people in the world. They were working on altering human genetics. There are references to things that are unspeakable in these documents. There are references to dead bodies of children being buried at this ranch, which, by the way, nobody has searched this ranch. Why has nobody searched this 10,000-acre ranch in New Mexico? Not the sheriff's department, not the state law enforcement, not the FBI. Like, what? Are you kidding me? And so the message is loud and clear. And notice, nobody's in jail. Right? When Pam Bondi, the attorney general, was asked in Congress about how many people are being investigated, how many people are indicted, go back and watch that video, folks. She's blabbering about the stock market, right? Really? The Dow? When we're talking about investigating and indicting some of the most vile criminals? So this is a loud and clear message to America that there are two justice systems, which we kind of that became obvious during the previous administration, but it continues to be obvious today. And by the way, there are people all the way in Trump's inner circle who are implicated in this. Howard Lutnick, of course, has now been exposed as a liar. He said he had nothing further to do with Epstein after that meeting in his house. We know that was not true. He went to his island with his children. Okay, and why is nobody being investigated? Why is nobody being indicted? There are a few small things happening in Europe. Of course, the former Prince Andrew, Lord Mandelson, the former UK ambassador to the United States, Torbjørn Jagland, the former prime minister of Norway, former chairman of the Nobel Committee, former head of the Council of Europe. He's now under criminal investigation. He's been indicted. We're grateful that he's had his diplomatic immunity lifted. But as far as the United States goes, nobody other than Maxwell is in jail. And that sends a really clear message, a very disturbing message about how the world really works.
And when you step back and look at the full picture, this is where the realization finally hits. What we're witnessing isn't just another cycle. It's a transition. A shift away from a system built on trust, debt, and control towards something far more grounded in tangible value. The exposure of global instability, the cracks in financial systems, the rising tensions across the world, all of it is pointing in one direction, and that direction is forcing capital to make a choice. Because at the end of the day, money has to go somewhere. It cannot sit in a system that is losing stability, it cannot remain in currencies that are being devalued, and it cannot rely on structures that are increasingly fragile. And when that shift accelerates, it doesn't move evenly. It concentrates. It flows into the assets that offer security, scarcity, and real-world utility. And that is exactly where silver stands. What makes this moment so critical is that the window to act does not exist before the full realization sets in. Right now, silver is still within reach, still relatively undervalued, still overlooked by the majority. But as we've seen throughout history, that phase never lasts. Once the broader market recognizes what's happening, once confidence fully breaks and demand floods in, the repricing is fast, aggressive, and unforgiving. And this is why voices like Alex Newman and are emphasizing urgency, not out of speculation, but because the conditions are already in place. The conflicts, the financial strain, the shifting global order, they are not isolated events. They are part of a larger transformation that is already underway. And silver sits right at the center of that transformation, positioned to respond when the system finally gives way. So the real takeaway here isn't just understanding what's happening. It's recognizing the timing. Because by the time it becomes obvious to everyone, the opportunity will have already passed. The price will have moved, the supply will have tightened, and the advantage will belong to those who acted early, not those who reacted late. If you want to stay ahead of these shifts and understand where the smart money is moving next, make sure you subscribe to the channel and stay informed, because this is a story that is still unfolding in real time. And remember, this is not financial advice, and you should always speak to a professional before making any financial decisions.